start with our motivation. Again, really with appreciation for the opportunity that we have. Not only the external conditions that are hard to come by, but also the internal conditions. Having the Buddha nature, having aspiration and faith in the Three Jewels, having curiosity, having spiritual longing. And so with this, these conditions let us really engage in the teachings and learn from them and put them into practice and make our lives meaningful for the benefit of sentient beings by progressing, however slowly, towards full awakening. So let's keep that as our long-term aspiration. And be very clear that that's what's motivating us. So, last time I left you with the question of, you know, do you want to continue with this, and are you willing to put in the effort needed? So two people here have responded, and I got one response from somebody who's watching it on, you know, on the streaming, but how about everybody else?
We would appreciate it if you would continue, please.
Okay, because it's yeah, two people here haven't said anything. You?
Oh, yes, please. I wrote you before. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yes, but please, yes.
Yeah. The letter from Heather is really rather touching, you know. She's much newer in the Dharma than most of the people here. And she said, since the beginning of these teachings about a year and a half ago, that she struggled most of the time. Things just weren't sinking in or making a whole lot of sense, but she kept showing up. And then about 6 months ago, she started listening to the previous week's teachings to review before the next teaching. And she found that really helpful, you know, because the thing is that you're not going to remember everything if you just hear this and then don't review it before the next week. Yeah, you won't remember it, you won't understand much. So she started doing that. And then about 2 weeks ago, she decided to start all over. So she started watching the lessons all over from chapter 1, verse 1. Okay. And she has more time because, you know, she's not working at the moment. And so she started watching the teachings more and meditating on them more and trying to be aware of the meaning during the day. And so that's also been very helpful. And now she said, the good news is I'm completely confused about why I was previously confused and struggling. You know? And you know, and what that means is when you put in the effort, then you still may not understand everything, but you're definitely much less confused than you were before. Whereas if you don't put in the effort, you're going to really be confused, and you're going to struggle, and you're going to feel, what's the use? Yeah, but if you put in the effort, then you know what the use is because you're creating it. Yeah. So it has to do with this mind of ours that expects to make progress without creating the cause, and this mind of ours that gets discouraged whenever somebody reminds us, hey, you've got to create the cause. Yeah? And so it's quite interesting to look at those aspects of our mind and how we, those automatic patterns that we have. You know, how can I kind of go along and get this without creating the cause? Because I'm busy doing something else. Yeah, which may also be good, but, you know, we are making choices. Yeah. And then the moment somebody reminds us, hey, please, you know, remember to create the cause, and they remind us for our own benefit, look at the habit pattern that we have of saying, what's the use? Yeah, and throwing in the towel instead of, like, listening and saying, oh yeah, it's about creating the cause, and no wonder this doesn't seem very familiar. I'm not creating the cause. If I put in some energy, it's going to be more familiar, and I won't have all this confusion about it. Yeah. So it's quite interesting to look at how our mind responds to these kinds of things, or how our mind thinks, well, it's somebody else's responsibility, you know. Like, well, I'm just, you know, a junior student, so this is for the senior students. You know, they need to make the effort, and then they'll know it. And I can sit back and rely on them, because nobody will expect me to know the answers to anything because I'm a junior student. Well, for sure you're not going to know the answers because you're not making the effort. Yeah? So it's not this thing of, like in school, you know. This kind of thing is said for our own benefit. Yeah? And to kind of make us think about the, you know, about causes and conditions, and that, you know, things exist due to causes and conditions, and it's up to us to create those causes and conditions. Yeah? So she said, although I find the teachings are difficult, although it takes a lot of time and effort and repetition, I'm finding them incredibly beneficial. And if it is beneficial for others, I'd like to request that we continue. Yeah.
So many people online are responding to this.
At the last minute, after somebody reminds them, then they send in. That's like when death arrives, you say, but Lord of Death, but, I'm not ready yet. Please, you know, wait a little while. Yeah, I want to practice the Dharma. So, you know, when we do the seven-limb prayer, we're always saying, you know, please turn the Dharma wheel, please remain until samsara ends. It seems like it's coming out of our mouth, but maybe we're not really meaning it. Yeah? I don't know. When we request it the last minute, or when we don't request, or when we throw in the towel, you know, what are the meaning of those two lines for us, you know, in the seven-limb prayer? And I know what really woke me up about that was in the 70s when I was sent to Italy. I was a baby nun, and I was sent to this Dharma center in Italy, and there was no teacher there, and I had been used to being with my teachers and having regular teachings, and all of a sudden I'm living in a place where there's no teacher. And in fact, I have to run the meditation sessions and everything. And that's when I really started making the request in those two limbs in the seven limb prayer, making them very earnestly, because I felt the lack of the teachings, you know, and it woke me up not to take that thing for granted, you know, that I actively had to request, you know, and similarly for our teachers to live long, you know, to make that request and to create the causes and not just say, well, whatever, you know. Okay, so,
I'm sorry for not making a formal request, because I thought I wrote you and you were gone to express how just sad I was that I hadn't reviewed the material, I wasn't familiar, and it really made me see that was essential.
Yeah. And, you know, if you review the material, it makes a huge difference. Huge difference, because then at least you're, you know, when you come to the next teaching, you have some idea what the topic is. Otherwise, if we don't review it, we really don't even remember where we were in the text or what we were discussing in the last time. Okay? So, we are on chapter 13 now. Okay, and we finished verse 306, talking about how, you know, one way to analyze things and see their dependence is by seeing that the whole objects depend on their parts, yeah, and that the parts, too, are composites in relationship to their components, in relationship to their parts. So what you wind up with is, you know, this, in, you know, ongoing infinite thing of everything having parts, and that means that everything is dependent, yeah? It's dependent on its parts, and something that is dependent cannot exist inherently, yeah? Because inherently means that it's just out there in and of itself. And, you know, it's really hard for us to... We hear those words, but it's hard for us to think about what they really mean in our own experience. His Holiness, when we were in New York, kept saying, you know, not only study the teachings and think about them, but relate them to your experience. Yeah. And just to realize, you know, whenever we look at something, it appears to be that object from its own side, you know, and it appears that every part of it is that object, you know, and this is a gong right there, you know, inside here. Because, you know, when we look at it, it doesn't seem like it depends on our putting the parts together and conceptualizing gong and giving it a label. It seems like it has, you know, its own entity, its own identity from its own side, you know? And it doesn't look to us as if it depends on parts. It's one whole thing. We look at it, it's one unitary thing, you know? And we don't think of it as having causes and conditions, it's just there. Of course, if we thought, we'd immediately recognize it has causes and conditions. But, you know, when we first look at it, well, it's just there. You know? And so similarly, when we look at people, you know, we don't think that people have causes and conditions. There's just a person there. And we don't think that all you need to do is change one small condition, and who that person is going to be entirely different. Yeah, when we look at somebody, it doesn't seem that way, does it? Seems like, okay, you could change a small condition, but person's still going to be exactly the same. You know, some small thing will change, but the person's exactly the same. But, you know, if there was just one karma that, you know, wasn't present, you know, all the rest of the karma couldn't ripen in the way that it ripened, yeah, for the person to be who they are right now. Yeah? So we're completely, dependent on causes, completely dependent on parts, completely dependent on name, term, and concept. And yet, when we think of ourselves, or when we look at somebody else, we think, oh, there's this, you know, person there. Yeah? Without even wondering what, you know, what is a person? You know, what's the definition of a person? On what basis do we say there's a person there? Okay, so now we're going on to verse 307. So this is talking about, the next set of verses is talking about refuting that sense organs apprehend objects by their own entity, and so refuting truly existent visible objects, and, you know, in the process, refuting others' assertions, their wrong beliefs. Okay? And so here in verse 307, we're going to start by the refuting by examining whether the color and shape constituting a visible form existing by its own characteristics are taken as the, you know, engaged object of a visual consciousness. And if the, you know, the color and shape of that visible form, are they one or are they different? Because we usually say that the visual consciousness perceives color and shape. Okay, and the color and shape are characteristics of the form. So are these characteristics, you know, the same thing, or are they different things? And how in the world are they apprehended? And do the color and shape exist from their own side, or do they exist dependently? Okay, so Joe Blow says, the pot is directly perceptible or perceivable since visual consciousness sees the pot's visible form, which exists from its own side and consists of color and shape. So they see the pot. Let's call this a pot instead of a gong. Can we call it a pot? Yeah, we can. Yeah, because that flat bottom, bulbous base, you know, water holder. It's not holding water at the moment, but it could. So it could actually fulfill the definition of vase or pot or whatever it is. Okay? So when we have this, it's saying that this, the pot's visible form, its color and shape, exists by their own characteristics, you know, by their own entity. And that is what makes the pot, you know, a directly perceivable. Because if they didn't have these characteristics from its own side, then it wouldn't exist. Okay, so that's what Joe Blow says. So then, okay, so the answer comes. Aryadeva says, well, are the color and shape inherently one, or are they inherently different? Because when we say the visible form, it perceives the visible form, it has to perceive the color and shape. We say, I see the pot, but actually we're seeing the color and shape. Yeah. So already there, that's some sign of dependence, isn't it? That we say we're seeing the pot, when in actual fact we're seeing color and shape. Yeah. And we're feeling cold, we're feeling hardness. Yeah, we aren't feeling the pot. Or are we feeling the pot? Are we feeling a pot that exists by its own entity, that is cold and hard? And what color is this? Brass colored? Yeah, so you have to say brass colored. But it's not made of, is it made of brass? Made of bronze?
Bronze.
Bronze? So bronze colored.
Well, I don't think that's bronze. I would say it's bronze.
brass, but bronze colored.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes.
You touched it probably with warm hands and said it was cold. What if somebody touched it with cold hands? Would it still be cold?
That's a very good question. If somebody touched this with cold hands, would it still be cold?
It might be warm to them.
Yeah. Very well might be warm to them. Good point. And as we can see, we're having a hard time determining exactly what color it is.
Well, color is just a wavelength. It's not anything solid.
But it looks like the color is here, doesn't it? It looks like...
It very much does look like it's there. However,
yeah. Yeah, it appears to us as if the color is there. But, you know, what's happening? This is just reflecting, you know, different wavelengths that interact with the, you know, the cones and rods in the back of our retina that then produce some kind of image in our brain that we call whatever we're going to call it, bronze colored. We can't call it brass colored if it's not brass. That's like calling an orange purple, even though it's orange. Okay. So, anyway, are the color and the shape inherently one or inherently distinct? Okay. If they're distinct, yeah, then how can a visual consciousness take shape as its object of comprehension? Okay, it can't because the shape is a distinct entity from the color. Okay, so because those two things are inherently different, when we see color, yeah, we would not see shape because a visual consciousness can only see one thing, you know. Okay. If they're inherently different, one consciousness couldn't perceive both of them. If they were inherently one, the color and the shape were one, then why doesn't our tactile sense apprehend color in the dark just as it apprehends shape? Okay, because it can be dark and you can feel the shape and say this is round. So if the roundness and the color were the same, were one thing, then when you felt the roundness, you should also see the color. Which you don't. But if the color and the shape are entirely different, then when you saw one with your eye, you couldn't see the other. And in actual fact, it would be really difficult even to see color without seeing shape, wouldn't it? Because whenever you see color, yeah, you're not seeing the whole universe as that color. You're seeing one patch. And whatever patch you're looking at has a shape, doesn't it? Okay. So you are seeing, when you see color, you automatically see shape. But they aren't the same thing, inherently. Yeah. They are different things, but they aren't inherently different. Because if they were inherently different, then, yeah, you could perceive the shape. I mean, you would... if they were inherently different, you couldn't see both the color and the shape at the same time. Yeah. So it's weird, isn't it? We've never really thought about that. Yeah. And so can the eye consciousness just see shape? Can you see a shape without seeing a color?
Does a silhouette count?
Well, a silhouette. Does a silhouette have color?
It still has tension.
try to see it, watch a poem where you eat ice cream in a snowstorm.
It's like what?
Watch a polar bear eat ice cream in a snowstorm.
Yeah, like watching a polar bear eat ice cream in a snowstorm. Right.
Vanilla ice cream.
Yeah, vanilla ice cream. Okay. Okay. So, then verse 308. Yeah. So, this goes on to refute to the consequence that because the elements, you know, the four elements, are present, a visual consciousness taking visual form as its object would apprehend both the causal elements and the resultant form. Okay? So that's if the cause and effect were inherently one. So I'll talk about that in a minute. The verse reads, only the form is visible, but the form's causes are not seen. If indeed it is thus, why are both not also perceived by just the eyes? So Joe Blow says the visible form source exists because the four great elements, which are causal forms, exist. Okay, so actually the visual form source is both the visual object and the sense faculty that's perceiving it. Both of those are considered the visual form source. Okay, so the resultant form is, let's take something where we can agree on a color or something. Okay, so a yellow tissue thing. Yeah, does everybody agree it's yellow? Yeah. Okay, so this is the tissue package is the result. The causal forms are the earth, water, fire, air, you know, from an ancient perspective, or, you know, whatever names of the kind of plastic molecules that are cellophane? Plastic? Yeah. Yeah, so whatever those molecules are called, and yet they're composed of other atoms, you know, that have joined together to make these different kind of molecules. Okay? So only the resultant form is visible. Okay? So when you see this, you say, I see a tissue package. You don't say, I see, are they called polymers or plastic? Yeah, polymers and what, plastic molecules. You don't say that. Those are the causes. You just say, I see this. Right? Okay. So the form's causes, such as the polymers or the earth element, you know, aren't seen, but only the result is seen. Okay? So the causal form, the elements, yeah, is imputed in dependence on the resultant form, the tissue packet. Yeah, so we call them causal elements because we see the result and we know that there were things that caused it. Okay, so they can't be, the cause and result can't be inherently different. They're related. Okay, so so the idea is by seeing an object, we impute the four elements that compose it. Yeah, they are objects of the tactile consciousness. The elements are object of the tactile consciousness. But the object is a visible form. So how can that be? Yeah, they can't be inherently different, but... Yeah, they have to be related, but if they are inherently different, then what happens? Okay, so if they're inherently one, cause and effect would be one. Mm-hmm. So the elements would be this. But we don't say we see the elements, we say we see the tissue packet. Mm-hmm. Okay? We impute the elements, which are the causes, on the basis of saying this, yeah. So the So the element and the resultant form are not inherently one, because cause and effect can't be one. They can't be inherently different, because then they would be totally unrelated to each other. And you could have the elements without having this. Okay? So in that, then lines, the two last lines. In that case, why doesn't just visual consciousness apprehend both the causal and the resultant forms? Because if they were inherently one, it should. Okay? So if the elements that compose this and this thing were inherently one, then the visual consciousness should see both the elements and this. Okay. Now we can say, well, it doesn't see them because they're inherently different. But if they're inherently different, then they couldn't be related as cause and effect. Okay? Then verse 309 is talking about if the cause and effect were inherently different. Okay? So earth is seen as firm and stable and is apprehended by the body, in other words, by the tactile sense. Only that which is tangible is referred to as earth. Okay, so the earth represents hardness, and that's only, you only sense that through the tactile consciousness. Okay, so only that which is tangible is referred to as earth, and that's perceived only by the tactile consciousness. Visual forms are objects apprehended by the visual consciousness, and the four elements are objects apprehended by the tactile consciousness. So they are different. Okay. Now, if you see them as inherently different in your mind, then you could see it. It's like, okay, there's those elements over there that are apprehended by the tactile consciousness. Here's the form over here that is apprehended by the visual consciousness. And it seems almost as if they have no relationship, because they have nothing in common. One's apprehended by one kind of consciousness, the other's apprehended by the other kind of consciousness. Yeah? Can you get that? Like, okay, if they're inherently different, then it's got to be like that. Yeah? But something doesn't seem right. But also, it doesn't seem right when you say that they're identical, because they aren't identical, because one, you know, is the elements, and one is the whole object, and the elements can't perform the same function as the whole object performs. So isn't that weird that you have all these parts, and all the parts can't do the same thing as the object? But when you assemble all the parts together in a certain arrangement, then they can do something that all the different parts can't do. But when you take an object apart into its parts, then the parts can do things that the whole object can't do. And yet, there's nothing that's really been added or taken away. When you put the parts together, there's nothing material that's been added or immaterial that's been added that gives those parts the ability to do something that they couldn't do when they weren't put together. And yet they can do it. It's like when you have a bunch of car parts and they're all scattered around, you can't drive it. You take those very same things, you put them in a different arrangement, you can get in it and drive away. But you didn't add anything to those parts then that wasn't there before. And yet, the whole object can do something that the parts can't. Similarly, if you have a car, Yeah. There, and you want just a wheel to put in the swimming pool and, you know, hang on to an inner tube. You want an inner tube for your swimming pool. You can't put the car in the swimming pool. Yeah. So if you dismantle it, then one of the parts can do something that it couldn't do when it was part of the car. But nothing was taken away or nothing was added so that the inner tube had that new ability that it didn't have before. Doesn't that seem kind of strange when you think about it? Yeah? Because when you look at everything, I mean, it really seems like it has its own inherent function or ability, and yet it changes function and it changes ability, doesn't it? Even though nothing changed in the object, except its arrangement and its relationship to other things. I'm kind of like watching the two kitties. For the viewers, we have a new kitty whose name is Mudita. Okay, so Karuna's on the sofa. Mudita just decided to come in. Okay, all of a sudden, Karuna is behaving differently. When Mudita was in another room, it was still Mudita. If you have inherently existent objects, it's Mudita in another room and Karuna in this room, and Karuna's sleeping. All you do is move Mudita and Karuna acts differently. Now how could that be if Karuna is inherently existent? Yeah, because if she's inherently existent, she has her own nature. And she can't be influenced by anything, and nothing would affect her. So Karuna could come and stroll around, and Mudita could stroll around, and Karuna wouldn't be affected. Or if Karuna hadn't woken up, Mudita could still come and strolling around, and Karuna wouldn't have been affected. Yes?
No,
where's Maitri?
No, it's bad.
Maitri's on the chair in the dining
room. Oh, okay. Yeah. Down over there. Yes? Yes, welcome to your first teaching, Mudita. Okay. So it's interesting, you know, when you think about how something appears to us, and then, who Karuna is dependent on who Mudita is. Yeah? And yet we look at them and they look like entirely different cats that have their own essence and own nature. But if that were the case, they shouldn't be able to affect each other. But they do. She thinks the carpeting is a
scratching
thing. Yes. We know you're sweet, sweetie. Okay. So if the elements and the color were one, the cause and effect would be simultaneous. Okay, so the point is here, okay, that the visual consciousness should be able to apprehend both the elements that are the causes of a pot and the pot if both of them existed by their own entity or from their own side, if they were one. Okay? But if the elements and the color were one, then cause and effect would be simultaneous. That doesn't work. If they're inherently different, then the elements would not be the causes of the whole. Okay? So if a color can be apprehended by visual consciousness, then its causes, the elements, should be able to be apprehended by visual consciousness. However, they're not. Okay? If the pot exists inherently, how could it have different parts, such as color, smell, tactile sensation, etc.? And if the pot is one thing, then all of those parts should also be one thing. Or if the parts are different, then the pot should be equally spread within every part, which would mean that you would either, every part would be a pot, would be a tissue package, or you would have part of a tissue package in every part, which would mean when you tore the tissue package and had a little bit of plastic, you would have a part of a tissue package in it. But I don't think you'd say that. I think you would say you would have garbage. Not part of a tissue package. Okay?
You certainly wouldn't say that that piece was a tissue packet, even if you did call it a part of one.
Yeah. Well, if the tissue package were in it, then, yeah, each part would have to be a tissue package. Or you would have to, you know, divide a pot. You know, pot would have to be divided into all these things. Yeah. But when you have the different thing, not pot, tissue package, I'm sorry. I need a pot, you know?
I've got a pot. You decided you could use that.
That's no, that's a gong. We can't figure out what color it is anyway. Next time we need a pot.
A power pot or a water pot?
Or maybe we just need to think of a cat, okay? You know? Is the cat the you know, the legs or the teeth or the fur? What part is the cat, you know? And if, you know, is the cat kind of spread throughout the whole thing? Yeah. And if you have one cat, then the cat has to be spread throughout all those parts. Which would mean then if you separated the parts, you would still have to have a cat. But that doesn't work. We are now having some interesting thing here. But this is good. This is exactly how sentient beings affect each other. How we feel like we're independent entities and I'm just me. You know, okay, I see things, I feel things, I think things, but I'm just me and I don't change. But how can that be? How can that be? When we're interacting with things all the time, and to interact, it means that we change. And it means that these things are affecting us, which means that we aren't independent entities. And speaking of independent entities, the computer isn't going to run independent of electricity, which it is running out of. Okay. So, 3:10. Since it was produced as something visible, it is of no use at all to the pot. As with the production of visibility, it lacks even the entity of existence. This verse I'm not going to even talk about because it's refuting the Vaisheshika's view. And I can't say that I understand the Vaisheshika's view because the Vaisheshika's, they're a non-Buddhist school, they say a pot is not a visible object existing by its own entity. And it's not even a visible object, since It's directly perceptible by virtue of possessing visibility, which is a separate generality, and generality is one of the six categories of existences for them. Okay, so not understanding this, I am not going to comment on this verse. But what I will comment on is what we're seeing here is that Aryadeva is taking Nagarjuna's teachings about emptiness and using them to refute the views of non-Buddhist schools and refute the views of even some of the Buddhist realist schools. Okay, so His Holiness mentioned this when we were when he was teaching Lekshe Ningpo, that, you know, Nagarjuna as such generally did not refute other, you know, he didn't mention other schools so much to refute them. He just laid out his refutation. And Aryadeva is really the one that's pinpointing the views of different schools and saying that they're wrong. I mean, Nagarjuna has a lot of Joe Blows asking questions, okay? But, yeah, it doesn't seem like he identified those people so well. Anyway, verse 3:11, yeah? The eye, like the ear, is an outcome of the elements. The eyes see why the others do not. Certainly, therefore, the subduer said, the fruition of actions is inconceivable. Okay, so this is about refuting that which perceives objects. So the previous verses were refuting objects, visible objects that existed by their own entity. This one is refuting that which perceives the objects. So we're going to have a few verses on that. So this is refuting that the eye, by its own entity, by its own power, is an instrument of looking at form. Okay, and it seems like that, doesn't it? Yeah, what does my eye do? It looks at form by its own power. That's what the eye does. You know, not that, you know, the eye has to depend on something in order to look at form. This is just what an eye is. It's the definition of eye, and that's the definition and the definiendum are one. Okay? So Joe Blow says, because the sense organs exist, for example, the eyes that are instruments of visual perception, directly perceivable objects such as visible form exist. So because you have the sense faculty, therefore you must have the object. Okay, the sense faculty exists by way of its own entity. As, you know, you have the sense faculty, which by its own power perceives visible objects, so there's got to be visible objects that exist by their own power. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, how could you say that there's a sense faculty that exists? You know, and define it as that which perceives color and shape, if there weren't color and shape that exist out there. So you have a sense faculty here, you have the color and shape out there.
Good point.
Yeah, so it makes sense, doesn't it? Okay. So, the answer, what Aryadeva replies, is since the eye perceives visual stimuli while the other senses don't, it doesn't perceive visible form existing from its own side. For like the nose sense faculty, it is an outcome of the elements. And the elements themselves do not perceive because they are particles that are part of the sense faculties. So when you think about it, okay? Think about your rods and cones. Think about your hammer and anvil? Okay. They're all just made of earth, water, fire, air. They're all just made of organic molecules of some sort. How come one can perceive colors and the other can hear sounds if their causes are the same? they're made of the same stuff, how come they have different functions?
They have different conditions. They only shape different things than other
hands. Yeah, they have different conditions. They're assembled in different ways. They have the earth, water, fire, air, the carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, what, are assembled in different ways. Yeah. So they have different resultant, you know, sense faculties that can perform different functions. But it's strange when you think that they all are created from, you know, the same kind of organic material. Or if you say, well, one has more nitrogen, one has more carbon, still they're all created from electrons and atoms and, you know, electrons and electrons and all the quarks and all the subatomic particles, okay. So the subatomic particles, they aren't nitrogen or carbon or oxygen or zinc or anything else, are they? They're just subatomic particles. Yet you form some of them together in one way and you get a metallic substance, you get form them together in another way, you get a gas, form them together in another way. Yeah, you get uranium. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Yeah. So how come, if they exist by their own property, exist by their own characteristics, and aren't affected by anything else, how come they form different wholes? Yeah? It's the same thing, the example with the car and the car pods, okay?
They're all related to different consciousnesses, but then why in the world are there six different consciousnesses?
Yeah, why are some sense faculties related to particular sense consciousnesses and not to others? You know, and that's when you see that identifying a visual object, a visual faculty, and a visual consciousness all are mutually dependent. Yeah? That these things can only be identified because of the existence of the other things. But when we think about, you know, we might say, okay, well, you have a visual perception because these three things come together, but we think of these three things as each one inherently existing separate from each other. So there's a visual object out there waiting to be seen that is a visual object, even if there were no sense faculties, there were no eye faculties or eye consciousnesses that ever exist, that would still be a visual object. And we think of the eye, you know, I mean, this is the way we think, isn't it? You know, that the eye faculty, you know, there it is, those rods and cones are sitting there, you know, with the ability to perceive, you know, colors and shapes from its own side, those rods and cones in there. So even if there were no colors and shapes, they still would have the ability. And the consciousness, the visual consciousness, is just kind of sitting there as a visual consciousness. And it's already a visual consciousness, even though it hasn't perceived anything. That's how we look at it. But when you think about that, that's crazy. How can it be a visual consciousness that isn't perceiving a visual object? And how can something be a visual object, be identified, have the entity of a visual object if it's not being perceived by a visual consciousness? And how can you call the eye faculty an eye faculty without those other two things? Yeah? So here's where we're really getting into not just causal dependence, that you need the eye, the visual object and the sense source and the immediately preceding consciousness, and that those three coming together cause, you know, the perception. We're not just talking there about causal consciousness, but about how the very identity of those things depend on the existence of the others. And yet, how we usually don't see them as depending on the existence of others. We're coming up to a verse about sound that's really interesting in this regard. Yeah. Okay. So due to its unique physical components, the eye sees visible form while the nose does not. So it's dependent on the eye, so dependent on the eye faculty's special physical form and the proportion of the different elements that compose it, it has a different ability. Yeah, so it's dependent. Okay. So, then Job Lowe says, okay, hold on a second. Okay, we're going to get into some more refutations here about why, yeah, something can't be an eye consciousness existing from its own side, but we'll wait until we get to that verse, okay? So Job Lowe says, if the eyes and so forth don't exist, it contradicts explanations concerning the maturation of karma, okay? Because our sense organs are maturation results, you know, of karma. So Aryadeva says, but we're not refuting that they're maturation results. So Job Lowe says, well, what is it? Why isn't that refuted? And Aryadeva says, we're not refuting that they're maturation results. We're refuting that they exist from their own side. Okay? So we're not refuting dependently arising things, you know, that the eye, because of the special arrangement of physical properties, has this ability. Yeah, because it's undeniable that the eye faculty sees visible form and it doesn't hear sounds. But we're refuting an eye faculty that is an eye faculty without depending on a visual consciousness or a visual object. Okay? So, although it can't bear ultimate analysis, and though it doesn't exist from its own side, it is undeniable that the eye faculty sees visible form and it doesn't hear sounds. Okay? So it says, thus, recognizing that the maturation of karma is inconceivable, we should accept it without applying analysis by reasoning. Okay? Because it's not something our minds can understand. So they give a sutra quotation here. The maturation of sentient beings' actions or karma is inconceivable. Thus, this whole world comes into existence through causes. So we were asking a minute ago, yeah, why is it that the eye faculty can see? Yeah? Well, this has to do with the maturation of karma, that there's an eye faculty and a visible object and a consciousness, a visual consciousness, okay? So the existence of these components has to do with the maturation of karma. Yeah?
The existence in any given moment, like moment.
Why we took a human body,
right,
with certain sense with certain sense faculties,
yes.
Our body is the maturation result of karma.
So all the different aspects of that is what we're talking about. That
the sense faculties that belong to this body are the maturation results of karma. They are also the physical results of the various atoms and molecules coming together that form them. Okay? So it's not just the physical things coming together, but you have to, there's a karmic element here because they're related to consciousness and they're able to serve the purpose of generating consciousness. Okay? So then, verse 3:12. Actually, we're time closing time. So, any questions so far?
So, with your last point, when a person is born blind,
mm-hmm.
it's still a maturation
of karma.
Of karma.
Yeah.
And there's still the elements and everything there, but because of those two things affecting each other.
Which two things?
The karmic maturation affects, would you say, affects then how the eye doesn't function?
Well,
or it's some of both.
Okay. Well, when somebody's born blind, then the rods and the cones and the eye organs, something's wrong
mm-hmm.
with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that person created the cause to be born in a body like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's the maturation result. It's not necessarily that the karma caused the organs to be defective. It's more that the karma caused the person to be born in a body whose organs were defective. Because it's the physical mm. things that are causing the physical result.
Mm. Mm.
Okay? So we shouldn't think that it's like when there's an earthquake, it's not that karma causes the earthquake. It's the physical things that go on that cause the earthquake. But it's the karma that makes us be in that place when the earthquake is going. And there is some karma ripening at the very beginning of the structure of the universe, you know, that's somehow related to sentient beings' karma, kind of what kind of elements they are and how they interact. But that isn't, Vasubandhu doesn't explain that in great depth. Yeah. So there's interplays. I mean, all these systems affect each other. You have karmic causation, you have psychological causation, chemical causation, biological causation, physical causation, many different causal systems. Okay? Yeah, so we don't say that karma makes all of those things. Yeah, but karma is involved in human, sentient experience of pain and pleasure, which relates to what's going on in the physical world.
Don't they sometimes, though, say that karma causes those things? Isn't there a school of
thought? There are some teachers who make it sound like karma causes everything. Some teachers do make it sound like that. But I asked His Holiness about this, and I'm telling you what he said. Also, because there is, in Abhidharma, it does talk about different systems of causation. Yeah. And Vasubandhu does say, you know, the world is created by mind and karma. Okay. But he doesn't explain exactly what that means. And when we say the world is created by mind, we think the mind thinks it and therefore it becomes. And that's not what the meaning is. Or if we say karma created that, we think, oh, magic created created it. Yeah. So,
With the concept of the mind creating things, is that more like the source, the mind being the source of happiness?
Yeah,
it's our perception.
Exactly. When we say the mind creates our experience, it's more in the sense of it, you know, creating our happiness and suffering. Because due to the mind, you know, the afflictions and the virtuous mental factors are part of the mind. And due to them, we create karma. And the karma influences the, you know, what things we encounter. And it also influences whether we experience pain and pleasure. when we encounter those different things. And the karma can also, karmic habits can also influence how we perceive things now by how, you know, what emotional kind of patterns we have too, how we put things together. Mm-hmm.
You know, in the four establishments of mindfulness, when we meditate on the body, we also try and break it down into the different elements.
Right.
Is that related to this analysis of cause, effect?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, that when we do the mindfulness of establish mindfulness on the body and the four establishments of mindfulness, it fits in very well here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you start taking the body apart and then you kind of wonder, well, how does it function? Now, you know, if every part is inherently existent, and none of them, and all these things have their own essence, then how come they're different when they're put together than when they're separate? Yeah? And how come when the skin covers the skeleton, we say the skin is beautiful, but when the skin is stripped off the skeleton and put on the table, we think it's horrific? It's the same skin. How come? You know, if this has its own entity, then it should be beautiful in both conditions.
What really got me was the, I think it's in Alan Wallace's book where he said, you know, the watch is made of an earth element, so is your body. And I was like, but they're different, they have to be different. And just, you know, just that statement was so disturbing to my mind.
Yeah, well, when you talk about the four elements, you have the external earth element and the internal earth element, you know. But why does our body, you know, have the internal element? Because we ate food. Yeah? So, you know, when the food is out there, yeah, if you called it body, because it's the cause of the body, then you're eating the body. Or if you call it dirt because it's the result of the dirt, then you're eating dirt. Yeah. So it's kind of true both ways, isn't it? Hmm? Okay.
Just a small point about the problem with the color of the gong.
Uh-huh.
Bronze and brass are actually the name of the metal.
Yeah.
Not the name of the color.
That's why I said we would have to call it bronze colored or brass colored. We can't call it. Yeah, because I'm aware that brass and bronze are the metal, not the color.
Yeah, so it wouldn't work to call colored. It brass colored, though. You could call it gold colored brass or dark gold. But bronze is not a color.
Yeah, that's why it would be bronze colored.
There's a bronze crayon. Come on.
Yes. It's not a glass crayon.
You can't call it gold. This is not
gold. It's not gold.
It's bronze. What color is bronze?
Bronze colored.
But bronze can be any color. It depends on how you heat it up and then you add the chemical and that changes.
But so an orange can be green too, but we all agree that there is an orange color. Right?
Brown enough to be brown.
Okay, I'll take a
softball. You can paint an orange and it would not change its shape though, as far as the shape and the.
Yeah. So can you have a green orange?
Yeah.
You can. They are green.
You can have a green orange. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we say people have the blues, but they don't turn blue.
Sometimes.
Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances, Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Guranamandalakam niryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Travesti Abbey in the West Florida.